All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Here we go again. Veterans Radio coming to you live on Talk Radio WAAM 1600 on your AM dial. We're also, those of you that are listening on the internet, at www.veteransradio.net. Be sure it's .net, right? Not .com. Okay. This is Bob Gould. My partner, Dale Throneberry's got the Sunday off. I've got a gentleman with me, a soldier who, well, I'll say hello to him now. Eric, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much, Bob, and thank you for having me back in the station today.
Guy's got a great voice. They should be in the radio. What the heck? But I'll tell you more about Eric. And just, a little bit of a teaser. He's been in both Iraq and Afghan. Ho, ho, ho. We should have a lot to talk about. Okay. Anyway, starting the program off, we always like to talk about things that are going on. And for that, almost weekly, I get all these announcements from Tim Workus. And Tim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, welcome to you, Bob.
Okay. Derek, can you give him a little more volume, please? Yeah, okay. Tim is the coordinator of volunteers, and he's the coordinator of the volunteer of the Freedom Center. Wow, the Freedom Center. Who's the Freedom Center? The Freedom Center is a hospitality center at Detroit Metro Airport for military personnel and dependents. Tim, do they have to be active duty, or can you be anybody, any military, you know?
Any military, and we accept all veterans. So we accept the VFW card or your VA card or any veteran. We also accept any NATO troops, Canadians. We get a lot of British, Italians, French. So we accept all veterans, all dependents, and all active duty, anything from a cadet from the academy to, three-star generals, privates, you name it, we take them.
Now, folks, why was there something like the Freedom Center started? Well, let me tell you this. There's no USO in the Detroit metro area. How about that? I guess they don't think it's going to be cool or whatever. Don't have enough. That's their business. So these gentlemen got together, and they formed the Freedom Center. That was a few years back. And now they're going strong. They receive no government money. So who sponsors you? How do you get your funds?
Delta Airlines is one of our major contributors, as is General Dynamics, Meritor, Oshkosh, Wisconsin. But also, for the big, kind of the big donations, but we get a lot of support from the American Legion, various posts of the American Legion, various VFW posts, the Jewish War Veterans, VVA, Marine Corps leagues. So we get a lot of contributions that way. Small $200, $300, $400, $500 contributions from various posts and chapters, auxiliaries. So that's what keeps us going.
Okay.
And we have a donation box, so as you're leaving, you can, drop a few bucks.
Well, if it's anything like the church offerings, I guess it gets a little slim, but we won't go there. Anyway, all right, so are you folks flush right now, or are you still struggling for money? I mean, can people donate?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I wouldn't say we're flush, and I wouldn't say we're broke. We're chugging along, but we can always use more capital. We've expanded besides the airport. We also now run two small freedom centers at the two military induction processing stations, one in Troy and the one in Lansing. So we actually have four centers, two at the airport and the two MEP centers. And, yeah, our website, mifreedomcenter.org, there's a donate button.
Ah.
So you can go there and donate. You can go on, if you shop at Kroger, you can go on your Kroger.com and specify a charity, and I think it's 0.5% of everything you spend at Kroger we get.
Wow.
Smile, I know a lot of people go to Amazon.com and buy things, but Amazon has a program called smile.amazon.com. So you can go on Amazon and register with the Smile program, same prices, but again, we get 0.05% of everything you spend at Amazon, we get that too. So there's a number of funding methods that keep us going. We spend about $8,000 a month just on supplies,
And could there, if somebody showed up at Metro Airport with supplies, what kind of supplies could they bring?
Well, you're inside the secured area of the airport, so you know the liquids are out. You know, you can't bring more than little 3 ounce liquids. But we're always, you know, we work with some hospitals, Beaumont Hospital. Paper plates, paper towel, plastic spoons and forks and knives, munchies, candy, those kinds of things. And if you have something big, a lot of stuff, then we can arrange to pick it up and deliver it to the airport through their loading dock system, which then gets it scanned and they bring it back to us. So there's a number of ways. If they go on our website, and there's a thing called donate. There's a wish list there. As an example, we have at all four centers, we have the Keurig coffee makers. And as anybody that has a Keurig knows, those little K-cups cost about 45, 46 cents a piece. And we go through probably 300 a month. So
yeah.
You can donate cases of K-cups.
Well,
that, you can bring that into the airport. You can put that right on the X-ray belt and bring it in.
I'm going to talk to Dale and our IT person, see if we can put a button on that would go directly to you folks so they don't have to mess around.
Sure.
Yeah, let's see if we can do that. So, Tim, we're going to be moving right along. We got a full program. I'm looking here at...
And just for your own, just for the radio listeners' information, last year at the Front of Your Freedom Center, we did over 62,000 active duty and veterans to the door. And since we opened in 2011, we're up to around 420,000. So we stay pretty busy. You know, you're looking at a couple hundred a day, 300 a day, depending on if it's a holiday season. And we try to, you know, provide a service to especially the younger. You know, I was 19, got off an airplane in Saigon, so we know what it's like when you're stuck in the airport and you've never been here before. So, you know, we try to take care of especially the active duty young kids that are passing through.
Well, I noticed you said young kids.
Yeah. Well, yeah. To me and you, Bob, they're young kids.
Yeah, they are. I know. Eric, you have a question for Tim?
Well, kind of. More of a thank you for the service, Tim, because being a current soldier of 17 years, I've done a lot of traveling across the country and have always made use of the hospitality centers like what you do, whether that's in Chicago, Atlanta, you know, the big airports around the that we have around the country. It's always great to be able to go in there, grab a snack, a soda, a coffee, you know, K-cup, as you said.
Right.
And whether it's not necessarily a familiar face, but it's a familiar uniform, and you're able to connect with somebody.
Ooh.
That's even if they're a perfect stranger, and that's really important.
Well, I like that. I think that we can end on that, Tim. We're gonna periodically have you on and have you bring us updates. And I want to know that for these other events, Tim always sends me every week. It's great long list pages of events. Is this the MI Veteran Events? Is that the site, Google?
Well, there's. I put them all on my site, Legion post328.org. But those also, I send them to Lansing, to the MVAA people up there in Lansing. And MVAA also runs a website of events for the whole state of Michigan. So mine is obviously concentrated on the Metro Detroit area, but you know, the Lansing site has my stuff, and then they put whatever's going on maybe in Sault Ste. Marie or Marquette or Western Michigan. My stuff is pretty much just for around here, but yeah, it's I started that about 7-8 years ago because you would go to something and you would not have a very good turnout, and because nobody knew about it, and I said, I guess I should try to do something to let people know about these kinds of events, be it a job fair, you know, from hiring our heroes to in the recent one we have coming up here in the Southfield area, an expungement thing where we have some judges and legal aid, and if you've got a few minor misdemeanors on your
PSA.
Record and maybe a small felony, and it's over 5 or 6 years
Derek.
Old, we get those things.
PSA.
Work with the court system, get them pulled off of there, so you have a better chance getting a job.
Okay, well, we're going to be moving right along. Like I said, we got a full program. We'll have you back on, Tim. So
sure.
You have a great rest of the day, and thank you for doing all that you're doing.
You're welcome. Have a good day, too.
Okay. Wow, and I want to read their mission here. I've got that. Okay. Where? the mission of the Freedom Center. Serving those who serve us. I like that. Remember the Kroger thing. I shop Kroger all the time, Kroger.com. And 5% of what you purchase goes to the Freedom Center. I guess you can do all that online. That really sounds cool. A couple of things very quickly going on. And here's something. There are free discounted tickets, or free, to local events. Okay. The Vet Tickets, that's the name of the organization, offers free or discounted tickets to sporting events. Aha. Concert, etc. Visit their website, vettix.org. Go ahead and do that, folks. I mean, save a few. You might have Red Wing tickets. Who knows? But anyway, and then there's something here coming up called the Weekly Detroit Ruck. Uh-oh. I'm going to have to ask Eric about that. Yeah, very quickly. That's every Sunday they're hosting a ruck starting at 10 o'clock. Okay, so what do you do? Why don't you come and email me, bob@veteransradio.net, and I'll be glad to give you this information on the ruck. And Eric, what's a ruck?
So a ruck march is a weighted pack, kind of like a big camping backpack, but military style. So it's got a metal frame or polycarbonate frame, and you're loading that down with 35, 45 pounds, and you're moving over a distance of, you know, a little ruck might be 4 or 5 miles.
That's what they say here, yeah. 6 miles.
Oh, a big one might be 12 to 25 miles.
So it's sort of a fast march, right?
Yeah, if you're moving at a mall walker's pace if you're really in shape for it. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that you want to go to bob@veteransradio.net and mention that you heard me talk about that, the ruck. I'd like to do more of that. So, and here's one more thing. The Desert Angels are hosting another packaging party. Okay, this is in Clarkston. And on Waterford Road in Clarkston. Remember that? They're called the Desert Angels. I'm sure it's the Oakland Sportsman's Club, okay? And that's going to be coming up on March 22nd. And, you know, all the neat stuff that what they need is coffee, hot chocolate, Girl Scout cookies, letters of encouragement. Ooh, that I could use a few of those. Everything from wipes to food products to snacks like dried fruits, neats. Tuna, gum, candy, even chocolate, new socks, toiletries, and everything else to serve our troops as they serve our country. You can make a difference. So, again, it's Desert Angels, and you're going to want a packing party. Eric, when you got that, I mean, socks?
Absolutely.
What about the Army? Did they give you socks?
Yeah, the Army gives you socks, too. But, you know, there's something about getting those care packages from home, even if it's from a complete stranger. The supplies really help the soldiers out. If it's snacks, if it's toiletry products, you know, I'd go into the chaplain's tent. He always was getting care packages in and maybe get a razor or a bar of soap. It's just your daily essentials, pretty much.
Well, I think that's great that we do that. So the Desert Angels, all right. Well, good. Eric can talk some more about it. We're coming back to Eric and to Kevin Hemel, who has been a regular. You know him. He's our emeritus historian for Veterans Radio. We're going to be talking about, Afghanistan, Iraq, Surge, before the Surge, Operation Desert Shield. My goodness, we got a lot to talk about right after this very important message. As Dale and I always tell you folks, have pencil paper ready. We get so much information. You will remember it. No, you won't. So remember, Desert Angels, I think that's a really cool thing. They're going to have a packing party on the 22nd. Well, here we go. Folks, if you're like me, Afghanistan, Iraq, boy, no play on words. It's foreign. Yes, it is. I'm trying to understand everything that goes on in Afghan and Iraq. And boy, I think we're going to get a little bit of clarification on that. And with me to start off is Eric Towell. Eric Towell, I'm looking here. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit very quickly. Here we are. I got your bio right here. Okay. You were in Afghan January 03. You were in Iraq January 04. And now you're with the reserves. Isn't that right, Eric? And you got a home here in Michigan?
That's correct, Bob.
Well, yep. Once again, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
I was told by a soldier about a year ago, and I asked him about Afghanistan, and he said, I'm trying to get his exact words, it was the most nothing place. It has nothing. That was his word. It wasn't like there's palm trees or dates or what. He said there's nothing there but rocks. And I mean, what did you find when you were in Afghan, Eric?
Beautiful mountains, absolutely stunning terrain, and I would love to go hiking in it if it didn't have landmines.
Oh yeah. Did you remove those when you left?
There was an ongoing campaign that other soldiers and coalition forces were working towards removing mines and going out into areas that were known minefields, so back during Soviet occupation. But the sheer number of mines and then not knowing where everything was either.
Yeah.
They were talking that it would take easily another generation to do a thorough job. Yes.
And how was that marked?
There are many ways to mark unexploded ordnance or minefields like that, whether that's stacked rocks, engineer tape. But known fields, yeah, were marked. It's the unknown fields that were the biggest danger.
And how about Iraq? Was that the same in Iraq or the...
No, there were palm trees there.
Yeah, okay. But Afghan, what do the people... I know they grow poppies. Is that it? Do they grow anything else?
Marijuana.
Okay. Well, they do drugs, right. That's interesting. But I know it's the strategic location that makes Afghanistan so important. And why don't you give a comment on that?
So for strategy purposes, having an overland route and presence for logistics to move men and materials through that area of the country to have a force of a presence, you know, was important, especially with, the ability to move men and materials overseas, you know, through the Atlantic to the Pacific. You know, it's much quicker by air and by land to do that through a corridor like Afghanistan.
A corridor? So you were you part of a convoy?
Yeah, we did a lot of ground assault convoys during our time in Afghanistan. We also did a lot of helicopter insertion if we had to go further away from our main installations.
By the way, folks, Eric served with the 101st and the 82nd. He and I both wear the Screaming Eagles patch, right? Huh? Yeah, sure. I know. All American 82nd. They're great guys, too, but there's something about that Screaming Eagle. And I remember, one of the things I remember going to Fort Benning, besides Jump Week, was the tower.
Yes.
Yes. I knew if I could do the tower, I could do it. What do you remember about the tower?
Well, I actually didn't get to do the 350-foot towers because of wind during my training weeks.
Oh, they didn't care. No, they did. Oh, I shouldn't say that. Yeah. So you didn't do the tower.
No, we just did the zip lines. And
oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that was week one, actually, mm-hmm. the zip line. And, you know, that was more scary for me.
Really?
Yes. I don't know. There was something about jumping out of that mock fuselage, and you, I mean, it's straight down. It's 30 feet, right? 40 feet, something like that. And you, I don't know, it just, it scared me. It's like jumping off a double height of a garage, and I almost didn't do it, and but I did. And then we had the towers, and we had Jump Week, and it's good to be with somebody right now that did both. And now let's go a couple of more things. All right, rules of engagement. Who could you not shoot?
Civilians.
Oh, hell, that's a good point.
Well, so our rules of engagement had changed a little bit from Afghanistan to Iraq in the year time frame between the two deployments. Like Bob said, yes, I was in Afghanistan January 03 to August of that year. And we carried our magazines loaded in our rifles wherever we went, whether we were on the installation or otherwise.
Was the safety on or off?
Well, safety's on, and we didn't have a round in the chamber yet, but time to activate or engage, we just have to charge it and flip it on fire, and we're ready to engage an enemy.
How many rounds in a magazine?
But these are 30-round magazines, standard load, 7 magazines of 30 rounds.
You were carrying 30 rounds magazines?
So, yeah, 210 rounds is a standard combat load.
And that's what you took in when you went out for the day to do your thing, right?
Yeah, when we're moving around, we have our body armor on, our load-carrying vest, water, helmet. And we were known as the helmet wearers there in part of the 82nd for the areas that we were in because we were the guys seen kicking down doors.
Boy, that must be really something. You wore gloves, and you told me in the break room why. Now, this is interesting, folks, because here it's very hot. Yeah, right? Am I right, Eric?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And they got gloves on. Why do they have gloves on?
This might seem counterintuitive to be wearing gloves in the desert, but a lot of our machines and equipment are metal, and that metal gets hot in the desert in that sun. So you're wearing gloves so you can work with your equipment so you're not burning your fingertips.
I'm glad I wrote that down. Okay, Derek, how much time? 2 minutes, right, before we go to the break? And don't forget, stick around, because we got Kevin Hebel is going to be coming on for the second half and be talking about Operation Desert Strike. 2 minutes, okay, real quick. Is there any website that our listeners can go to get more information that you might know about?
Not off the top of my head.
All right, very quickly. Oh, we were talking showers and water. I'm sure you don't have an inordinate, I mean, you have a supply. Does the water get reconstituted?
So we do have water purification teams in the Army. But a lot of what we had for ourselves drinking-wise was bottled water. And then you had a potable brand of water that was trucked in, put into bladders, hooked up to our shower containers, basically big shipping containers that have been converted to shower stalls and bathroom stalls. And And all I could help but think is an engineer somewhere designed that and must have made a pretty penny
for
coming up with that logistical solution.
Yeah, yeah. So you each, showers, but that water wasn't wasted, right? That was reconstituted.
As far as I'm aware, yes.
Yeah.
We could repurpose and repurify water if we needed to.
Okay, how are we doing? All right, we got a minute, and I think our orchestra is getting up, the Veterans Radio Orchestra. And yeah, I can hear them now. They're warming up, and I'll be back with Eric Toll from the 82nd and the 101st Afghan Iraq. He's in the reserves now up in Wisconsin, right?
Yes, my new reserve center is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Milwaukee, the town that made who famous? I can't remember, beer famous or something like that. So we'll be right back. Don't go away. It's Veterans Radio, Bob Gould. You're listening to Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. Okay, thanks, Derek. Okay, we got right back to the program, so we got a lot to do. Right now, coming on the program is Kevin Hemel, and Kevin Hemel is a historian for the U.S. Air Force, Surgeon General at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. Oh, boy. He's also a historian tour guide for Stephen Ambrose's historical tours, and that's World War II tours on D-Day. Oh, that should be interesting. Well, I'd sure like to go to that. He's also the research director for Sovereign Media, and that publishes WW2 History and the History Quarterly magazines at Sovereign Media. He also has a number of books, and we'll mention those in just a little bit. One of them, a lot of it on Patton. If you like Patton, he has a book, real coffee table size, Patton's Photographs. Little that people know, but Patton wanted to take the photos as he saw the war. And if you notice, now that you heard it first on Veterans Radio, he has most of the shots, he has a camera around his neck, along with the binoculars. So it was all a part of that. Kevin holds a master's degree in American history from Villanova University. He's appeared on the History Channel, American Heroes Channel, Fox News Channel, and C-SPAN. Kevin, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, good to be here, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good to have you. Boy, we've had you on quite a bit, but you're our go-to historian. And recently, I saw a History Channel program on Operation Dragon Strike. Tell us about that.
So Dragon Strike is part of the surge in Afghanistan under President Obama. And the intention, this is down in the southern section of Afghanistan, in the Kandahar region, where the Taliban had really been kind of taking over. So we send a brigade from the 101st Airborne to pretty much sweep through an area. It's called Highway 1, which was a highway leading east to west out of Kandahar. And, that sweep kind of cleared the enemy out, enabling the farmers to return to their farms and kind of bring peace to the area. So it was a very successful operation. It goes on right about September of 2010, and it really brings peace to the area. But it was a complex plan on multiple levels. And one of the things I wrote about was a fight in a place called OP Dusty. And so the idea was to send three companies into an area, and the battalion commander wanted somebody in a blocking position to prevent reinforcements to get into this area. So they basically air assault a platoon of airborne or air assault scouts with the 101st. They occupy a small compound and fight surrounded for 2 days with the Taliban.
Now, I got to stop right there because I saw the program. I looked at it twice, and every time I see something on Afghan or Iraq, it drives me crazy that we got all this air power. We got Apache helicopters. We got F-15s. We've got automatic drones, whatever. And yet, I don't. And Eric, I want to ask you that. Why was there airstrike called in every time? I mean, I wonder. I see these guys getting surrounded at OP Dusty, and they showed the command center, and they were, well, we're monitoring it. Well, where was the aircraft, Eric?
Well,
I mean, did they come? Did you call them in?
Yeah, I had air support on several of the missions that I was on, whether that was Apache coverage or even Harrier coverage. I remember some missions we had B-52 coverage.
No, they dropped B-52 bombs?
Well, we didn't use it, but we had that asset on hand. Now, as far as why it's not being used in the scenario or the program you were just referencing, there must be a missing piece of information that just wasn't released to the public on why they made that decision.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kevin, you comment on that.
Sure. No, they had plenty of air support. They had Army helicopters, Air Force ground air support, and Navy. But, and I'm sure Eric can speak to this better than I, you really need boots on the ground to confront an enemy, especially in an insurgency. The soldiers that I interviewed for this story told me about how the Taliban really used the terrain to their advantage, hiding from air support. They would actually fire smoke grenades at the enemy. There was a lot of marijuana fields, grape fields, pomegranate fields, and then there were a lot of clay huts that they would use to dry this material in. And the Taliban used all of that to their advantage. They even had small, the different farms were divided by walls, by like clay walls. And so they were able to use this, much like the Germans using hedgerow country in the Normandy region of France. And so they said, you know, we were calling in all of these airstrikes, but, you know, these guys kept firing at us. And it wasn't until support troops came in. In fact, they were under fire from a hut they kept referring to with a red door. And Captain Foucher, the platoon leader, told me he was calling in strike after strike on this hut. But then every time the smoke cleared, the fire would just continue. And it wasn't until some strikers, medium-sized armored vehicles, came down to the area to knock them out with direct fire that the Taliban would just keep escaping air fire. Eric, you can elaborate that if you can.
Yeah, I can elaborate a little bit. So what we saw here was a evolution of the tactics that the Taliban was using from the time that I was there to, you know, the story that you're referencing, and that they didn't like getting pinned down. We would chase them down into bunkers, into cave systems, was the primary function that we did in 2003 in Afghanistan, especially in the northern region where I was at. And once we got them pinned into an area like that, we could paint the target with a laser, call in an airstrike with a guided armament, and drop 18,000 pounds of explosive on a pinhead, and take care of it. But when we got to Iraq, for example, some of the things we had to do, we had to get Abram assets, armor on the ground, line of sight. Or possibly even knock the building down with the tank itself rather than shoot it with the main gun. Just drive through it, be done with it.
Comment on that, Kevin.
Yeah, you got to use the tools in the toolbox that you have. And, for all the strength that air power gives you, air power can't take prisoners or hold ground. You really need those soldiers there, present, making those decisions to really win the day or not. And to hold those kind of positions. So, there's the great advantages to the kind of accuracy, the high tech munitions that we have, but it really comes down to a well trained soldier, or Marine or sailor, in an area that is the difference between success and failure.
Now, when Operation Dragon Strike came, folks, in 2010, September, I believe, 2010, the Americans, the intel, intercept some of the chatter coming from the Taliban. I'll read you a couple. The new unit is in, and they are barbarians. That's what they said about the 101st. Well, okay. They also said the Black Hearts are on the move. There we are. The Black Hearts are on the move. Stay away. Tell us about that, Kevin.
Well, I can tell you, usually if they're calling you barbarians, it means you fight really well. So, you know, they're trying to use propaganda to paint the enemy. Now, the term Black Heart, I'm going to have to speculate here. I believe that's one of the battalion or brigade symbols for one of the brigades in the 101st. It's a spade. It's the four, used to be the four, you know, parts of a deck, you know, a card deck. And, you know, speaking on a larger scale, we were, you know, listening to almost every conversation they were having in Afghanistan. They had very rudimentary communication, and we had some of the best in the field. So we were able to really, that was probably our best way of getting casualty counts, was they would talk about it after the battle. And a lot of times soldiers would, you know, when they captured the enemy, they would grab their phones and, you know, find out what their messages were. I mean, it was a ready access piece of information that we would get from them every time we captured anyone.
Now, the surge that happened in 2010, you said that the war in Afghanistan had taken a dramatic turn. Give a comparison before surge and after surge.
Before surge, Taliban kind of ruled the not as much the cities, but definitely the countryside. They were sowing mines and fields. Farmers couldn't, use their own fields. Just about every other hut was a bomb-making factory. And we just didn't have enough soldiers there to really patrol and keep the area safe. And so the surge in Afghanistan, much like the surge in Iraq, really brings peace to the region, because you suddenly do have that many soldiers. And basically, once you clear and sweep an area and then continue to patrol it, you bring peace, you bring trade. One of the soldiers said when they got down there, you know, Highway 1, where vehicles were ambushed all the time, you didn't see vehicles out on the highway. When they finished Dragon Strike, they said, you know, it was like at night, it was just a line of lights, the traffic. You know, it was almost bumper to bumper, because that kind of freedom brought that kind of peace, and then sort of brought a little bit of an economic boom in that area, too. And the civilians, you know, I were told on numerous occasions, were coming out to the soldiers and thanking them for their presence.
Wow. Did you find any of that, Eric? How were the civilians, Eric? How did they treat you?
Well, the most contact I had with the civilian populace was in Afghanistan around Bagram Airfield, and we would regularly bring civilians onto the installation to do manual labor for us, that under guard, of course, but that would free up soldiers to be able to do other activities.
Like what kind of act? I mean, what would they do?
Well, some things might be reconstruction labor, so rebuilding maybe some of the hard buildings, the brick and mortar stuff that's on the installation. I remember there was a mosque that was being rebuilt right behind the infantry compound around the time I had left. Or maybe we need them to help move bags of salt that we maintain for the runways, because in Afghanistan, especially up in Bagram towards the mountains, it gets cold. It ices. It snows.
So you had to have salt?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad we got a first-hand account here, folks. Getting back to OP Dusty, what I saw and the drop of the supplies, they get resupplied, and it went outside the compound. And I guess, well, I wondered when the Americans had to go outside the compound, I noticed that, boy, I would have thrown those bags of ammunition, and they wound up putting it over their shoulder and carrying it. Tell us about that, Kevin.
Sure. Well, there was such a high volume of fire around OP Dusty that they actually had to call in for a daylight resupply, which is rarely done. The resupply is usually done at night. They had to go all the way to the battalion commander to get this permission. And when the Black Hawk helicopter flies in with this resupply, it comes immediately under fire. The scouts around the compound are firing back, trying to, you know, keep the area clear. And all the confusion, they kick out the ammunition. They're in boxes, and they also are using body bags. They call them the high-speed bags filled with ammunition, and they fall outside the compound wall. A line of curses goes up from the guys on the ground. One of the sergeants puts a quick team together, and they run outside the compound walls, retrieve the ammunition, and most of it they're throwing over the wall into the guys in the compound. It's coated with mud and everything, and they're having to wipe the mud off it so they can use it. And then the rest they drag back into the compound. But, you know, I saw the, well, I was in that documentary, and they did kind of, sort of use poetic license because it was a very quick operation and they did not come under fire, during that period. I think in the show, you know, they're firing at the Taliban about 20 yards away, and that really didn't happen. They ran out, grabbed the ammo, threw most of it over the wall, and then pulled the rest of it back through the gate in the compound.
Wow, I saw that, and my heart was in my throat. Derek, you want to do a quick PSA. Kevin, I know you're not going to go away. Please don't. We'll be right back. You're listening to WAAM Wham Talk 1600. Boom, boom. We're back on Veterans Radio Talk Radio 1600 WAAM right here in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. Kevin, you said this about the Taliban. Once they lose momentum, they will retreat to fight another day. Tell us about that.
Sure. They're not looking to take sort of make a conventional victory. They're insurgent fighters, and you know, they don't see retreat as any kind of defeat. You know, it's shock them and scare them and survive to fight another day. They're actually very good at picking their wounded and dead up off the battlefield, preventing the Americans or even the Soviets back in the day from making body counts and getting an assessment of how effective their, you know, tactics and abilities, you know, were in a battle. But I'll tell you, the soldiers I interviewed had a great respect for the way the Taliban fought. A lot of them were veterans of previous tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they said some of the fighting around OP Dusty was the most intense they'd ever seen.
Do you have a comment on that? Anything on Eric? Eric, look, I got to say, Eric has got a very close friend is right now in the dire straits here in Ann Arbor, and I think he's a little bit distracted, but that's cool. I mean, he'll be going right after the program to the hospital and take care of his buddy. We all take care of each other, right? Right.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. OP Dusty, though, we're back to that, and... Well, there's still something. I mean, they had to hold that. Why weren't we not patrolling Highway 1 with aircraft? Come on, what's going on here? Why did we have to put soldiers at risk? Why was that?
Well, you know, because the Taliban is very good at infiltration and ambushing. It's hard to patrol, you know, miles and miles of highway with jets. And even helicopters, and so you needed those boots on the ground. You needed to push them physically away from the highway to make it safe. I can tell you the great advantage we had was the air power. We also had artillery and mortars. The Taliban was really fighting with machine guns and, you know, some heavy machine guns, and the fighting was so intense. We were actually using anti-armor weapons. We had something called the AT-4, which the guys would fire from the rooftop at, you know, the heavy machine guns. And at one point, the captain and his JTAC and his artillery spotter were coming up the steps to the second floor where one of the guys was preparing to fire the AT-4. And he shouts out, backblast area clear, because there's such a heavy backblast on these weapons. But because they were coming up the steps, they didn't hear it. And they got caught in the back blast, and the captain, who's in charge of the whole platoon and what's going on, lost his hearing for about an hour. So that's the kind of the things that, you know, you really don't read about or see too often, that is just a real reality of combat. Sort of all those things that can go wrong can, and you run out of everything except the enemy. So that's why you have to really be down on the ground in the weeds to really remove an enemy. I mean, we had great fire support in Vietnam, and we still had great difficulties there.
Eric, the first time somebody shot at you, I got to ask everybody. Dale does. What did you think? I mean, I've heard that from veterans.
Never
had a life until somebody shoots at you. Tell us about that.
So my first reaction is a quote from, I believe, General George Washington, but that was a different era of warfare. He had said, I've heard the bullets whistle by, and believe me, there's something charming in the sound. He's a liar. I'll say that much.
Yeah. Kevin, comment on that when you interviewed guys. What can you add to that?
I actually ask that of just about everybody I interview, and I've had a few exceptions, but just about everybody I ask, what was your first reaction when you got fired at or you were in combat? And they said, I thought, I made a big mistake. What am I doing here? And one of those people was Major Dick Winters. He told me when he first parachuted into Normandy, when he landed, that was his first thought, is what am I doing here? And a lot of times, other vets have told me that it's the guy that's so full of ego. You know, when I get in there, I'm going to kill all the Germans or the Japanese or anything. And they're usually the first ones to go, man, let's get the heck out of here. Eric, was that at all your experience the first time you got fired on? Did you think, what am I doing here?
Oh, man, my very first mission in Afghanistan, I remember going out and getting in that helicopter, into that Black Hawk. And we're going into the, I believe it was an insertion into the Koh Isofi mountain range. And there's a mist, visibility is poor. And we exit this aircraft and set up a perimeter. And it was kind of like that. It's like, I'm going through my head, just remember my training.
Yeah.
These are the things we're supposed to do. Sectors of fire, just trying to get back to the basics in my mind. But I'm nervous. As a young 19 years old, what am I doing here on this mountainside?
You were at the prom 12 months before, right?
Yeah.
Comment on that, Kevin.
Eric's reaction is the most natural reaction of every soldier. That, you could be sitting home playing Xbox, watching TV, going out and having a beer, but no, you're putting yourself in harm's way. And there's no place you'd rather, you'd rather be any place but that. But, and then usually what I hear, and Eric, you can comment on this too, please do, is when it happens, things happen so fast, a lot of times they say we didn't even have time to be scared. But it was when the fighting stops and the sun goes down that the nerves kind of hit and the nervousness, arrives. Some people have told me about getting sick afterwards. Others are just, exhausted. In fact, that's basically what a lot of these guys at OP Dusty told me. That was a two-day fighting surrounded. And they said when the sun went down, they realized all their adrenaline had drained out. Some of the guys couldn't even move their arms. And Eric, what you were talking about earlier about wearing gloves in combat, a lot of these guys said they burned their hands through their gloves because they were firing so much that day.
Yes. The exhaustion of battle is real. It's
kind of hard to
describe because it's not just in a physical drain. It's an emotional drain. You're wired running on your training. It's not the same as autopilot, because everything is calculated. You're functioning as a group, as a team. But when you get that time by yourself after the fact, it's and you kind of reflect upon what you just did and what your group just did. Yeah, it's a crash. Much deeper than anything like coming down from drinking three cups of coffee. Indescribable in
a
lot of ways.
Could you sleep that night when you went back?
Sometimes, yeah.
I mean, did you replay the battle?
Yeah, that happens too. And every soldier is different in their process and how they cope. But the one of the important things is that we're there as a group. There we have the ability to lean on each other in that shared experience. Whether we'll talk about it later, but right now, hey, let's take a minute to ourselves and commiserate, yeah. You know, what we just did.
Boy, I think, you know, I'd like you both to come back and we can talk, because we've only got 4 minutes left, can you believe? But we will devote a whole program to being back. Kevin, I'm certainly going to have you back again. But I want you to comment, Kevin, on above the battlefield were drones and satellites sending back images. Good gosh. How effective was that, Kevin?
Well, with OP Dusty, they really weren't using... I think they did use one drone to fire a missile at something, but it was really F-18s. It was Thunderbolt, you know, the ground support Air Force plane, Apaches and Kiowa helicopters in that battle. So it really was a very live human, response every time it was requested. In fact, the Taliban got so close. I think they got within 25 meters of this surrounded outpost. That's how close they were able to get to the Americans. And they called in an airstrike, I think it was of F-18s, using what were called JDAM missiles. And one of them came in so close it rattled the whole compound. One of the guys said he felt like he got punched in the chest. And, the forward observer guy, the guy calling it in, said, hey, that wasn't me. I didn't do it. But they knew what an expert he was, and they trusted him. As time moves on in Afghanistan and Iraq, yes, the amount of drones, because drones are cheaper, if they get shot down, you don't lose a man, become much more prevalent. I've never really examined the setbacks and the advantages of drone warfare, but it is a cheaper way to do things. I know that once we pulled the majority of our fighting troops out and had advisors in Afghanistan, the guys would float their own drones, and in one case at night, they would attach glow sticks to it. And when a sergeant proposed this idea to his battalion commander, he said, why are you doing that? He says, because they don't know what it is, and it'll spook them. So, you use everything that you got, because you never know what'll freak the enemy out without even having to fire a shot.
I love that story, Kevin. And that was that's right on. Yeah, if it scares them, yeah, it gives you the edge. Absolutely, make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, yep. Kevin, the band is getting up, the orchestra. We believe we got another program under our belt. Of course, you're going to come back. We're going to talk. We're going to get Eric. I hope he can write. Eric, you're going to come back.
Absolutely.
And so, Kevin, you have yourself a great day. Thank you very much for giving up a portion of your Sunday to Veterans Radio and all the military people that are listening. I know they enjoy hearing from you, and so you have yourself a great day, okay?
Hey, thanks, both of you. And Eric, if I got anything wrong, please correct me.
Oh, not a problem. Will do in the future.
Thanks.
All right, great. Take care, guys.
Thank you.
Oh, boy, here we go. Wow, Eric, a program's under the belt.
That would be number two.
We got less than a minute. You get the last word, real quick.
Real quick, I'd like to give a shout-out for my friend, a fellow soldier that I've worked with for the past 6 years. He's in the hospital right now, and prayers and thoughts to him and his family as they go through this trying time. Matt Woodard.
Okay, and is he critical?
Yeah, it could be days.
Okay. Well, Matt, let's give a few prayers for Matt. And I think we're just about done. Right, Derek? This is it. Bob Gould, until next week, Veterans Radio, come on right back. You are dismissed for now.